Today's show focuses on Monteverde, Costa Rica. With it being Earth Day, I think it's very suiting that we're going to talk a lot about ecology and conservation. I hope you all enjoy this framing for your wonderful Earth Day. This past spring break, Skidmore had a travel seminar to Monteverde, Costa Rica with 14 students and two professors, and I was lucky enough to be one of those 14 students. It was just an amazing trip with such a beautiful environment to be living in, and we all truly learned a lot about the environment and conservation, and also about ourselves. And just before we begin this show, I just wanted to extend an enormous thank you to Monica Ravere-Rick and Anne Ernst for being the two professors on this trip and for planning it to a T. In addition, I'd like to thank the Monteverde Institute with everyone there that put all their effort into planning our trip, and Mark Wayne Wright for being a wonderful guide on the trip. Today you will hear from two people. The first person is Mark Wainwright. As I said, he was our guide on the trip. You will also hear from Chloe Larson. She is a neuroscience major and a senior here at Skidmore. And Chloe has a wonderful take on our experience in Monteverde. And so with today being Earth Day, I just wanted to say that hopefully this show gets you excited about the environment and potentially makes you want to go and volunteer. We may not live in the rainforest, but the environment of Saratoga Springs, New York is still very, very lovely and beautiful. Be sure to take some time to go outside and really embrace the environment around you. We're very lucky with what we have. Just a little bit of background of Costa Rica. Costa Rica is in Central America. It is neotropical, so we're in the temperate zone in upstate New York, but Costa Rica is closer to the equator, and as a result has essentially constant temperature throughout the year, with their seasons defined by precipitation and not defined by temperature like the seasons are here, with winter being very cold and summer being very hot. In Costa Rica, there's a wet season and a dry season. So that's just a little bit of background. So being near the equator, Costa Rica gets a fair amount of precipitation. And so areas like this, we can find rainforests. And when we visited Monteverde, we were lucky enough to experience cloud forests, dry forests, a variety of forests. Adrian Forsythe lived in Costa Rica for a number of years, and in his book, Nature of the Rainforest, Costa Rica and Beyond, he includes a section about Monteverde. I just wanted to read to you all parts of his section because I believe that they very eloquently describe Monteverde and all its beauty. More than 30 years ago, for reasons that now seem dim and curious, I found myself in Guanacaste, Costa Rica, studying the social life of tropical hornets. Guanacaste was sun-baked and wind-blown throughout its long dry season, but it did have an abundance and diversity of large hornet nests. Usually this is a good thing, but occasionally the attractions of this pursuit wore thin, especially after an attempt to catch and mark a large colony of wasps had gone painfully wrong. Some nights, as I lay alone in my dusty bed, sweating with some body part throbbing from wasp venom, while the fierce trade winds shook the roof and rattled the shutters, I dreamed of the cloud forests around Monteverde. Half a day's drive away up the mountain slopes was a lush,
varied paradise.
To be sure, there was plenty of wind in Monteverde, but it was cool and laden with mist. It was a pleasure to be up there, sitting in the mossy lee of an epiphyte-laden tree, watching the scudding clouds come from the Caribbean side and sailing across the continental divide. As the clouds crossed to the Pacific slope, they often thinned into drifting mist. On the wispy leading edge of these mists, the water droplets acted as a trillion tiny prisms, and then the drifting rainbow they made would dissolve as the droplets sifted down onto the vegetation. The mist made it a good place for those of an amphibian persuasion. Walking at night, I would routinely see tree frogs and salamanders lollygagging on the leaves, their skin moist and glistening in the light of my headlamp. Of course, it was an amphibian that put Monteverde on the map for biologists. The once amazing golden toad, the males of which were a hallucinatory, intense golden orange, was found only there. This toad was first reported by Jerry James, one of the Quaker dairy farmers who settled Monteverde and who eventually created the Monteverde Cloud Forest Preserve to protect the breeding habitat of the golden toad. The male toads would congregate by the hundreds around the temporary pools made by the first heavy spring rains. They waited for females to arrive and stimulate the copulatory frenzy that preceded egg laying in these pools. The golden toad was last seen in 1989. If you could just introduce yourself so that the audience knows a little bit about you and your background.
My name is Mark Wainwright. I have lived in Costa Rica since 1991. And my first work here was as a wildlife illustrator. And that has morphed over the years into an interest in environmental education in general and conservation.
You work in Monteverde with the cloud forest and the surrounding area. Could you go into the importance of rainforests?
The importance of the Monteverde area where I work, and in particular a large area of protected forest called the Children's Eternal Rainforest, has several facets. It's really the cornerstone of the local economies as an area where ecotourism really fuels many of the local activities. It's tremendously important in our region as a watershed because the forests act as an umbrella that protects the thin, steep topsoil during our heavy tropical downpours, and as a sponge which absorbs cloud water which gets driven up our region, up the Caribbean slope by the trade winds, condenses on the vegetation, and then feeds down to many communities and farms, and in the case of Costa Rica, hydroelectric projects. And our particular area feeds a large hydroelectric project called Arenal Lake, which provides electricity for about a third of the country. So those are two very important practical considerations to forest conservation in our area. But to me, the number one reason, something that we talked about a few days ago during your visit here, is as a reservoir of biodiversity. And that can be something that is sometimes difficult to put into words, but to imagine the world as a big mowed field, and imagine that in the middle of that field there is a spring that gives life to all kinds of plants and animals, and point out that most of us would not intuitively run our lawnmower over that particular patch, perhaps in part because it provides water or might provide medicine or clean air, but the main reason that most of us would respect that little piece is because it's cool and it's our heritage. And I think most people would agree that they would leave that magical spot and try to cherish and preserve it. And of course, our particular area is not the only patch in the field. There are many, but the Monteverde area that I work in is arguably one of the most biodiverse spots on the planet. It straddles the continental divide, the backbone of the Americas, in a very narrow portion of the Americas. And since the rain comes up one side and it's very dry on the other side, there is stratification of different climates that generates perhaps unmatched biodiversity. So the amount of flora and fauna that is protected in this particular area, and the Children's Eternal Rainforest in particular, is really off the charts. So to me, it's protecting that magical heritage that is the number one reason.
Was there any reason why you decided to settle down in Monteverde and work so hard to preserve the rainforest in this particular area?
No, I came here at first because I had an interesting opportunity for work, and I had the idea that I might do some wildlife illustration work, which was a combination of two interests of mine, and I started to do that, and one thing led to another, and there have just been ongoing interesting reasons to stay and learn about and teach about and strive to conserve this area. So I never came here with a big plan, but I think inevitably, as one starts to become fascinated with an ecosystem, one tries to convey how special it is to others and chip in to try to preserve it. And really, that is and continues to be a great passion for me in this particular area.
So you gave the analogy of a mowed field with just an area of biodiversity in the center. I guess nowadays there are some threats to rainforests, you know, a mower of sorts. Could you kind of go into how the rainforests are being threatened?
I think the number one factor for me, or the root of other factors, is a deficiency of environmental education. And that has influenced me to focus on that in my own work. I think that there's a fascinating body of scientific work that goes on, but that is not always conveyed in a rich, clear way to a broader public. And I think in our modern lives, it's very easy to perceive the natural world as, you know, the woods in the back, and perhaps forget about how important and how special and how fragile they are. So I would, you know, maybe unconventionally say that environmental education is ultimately the greatest challenge, because the whole world should understand how special our remaining natural areas are. Now, of course, within that, there are numerous threats. And one of the phenomena that have focused our discussions on what those threats are, and in some cases how we might deal with them, has been the very sudden demise of a large number of amphibians. In this area in the 1980s and in many other areas around the world in other specific years. And that has led to an analysis of all sorts of issues that could have played a role here or elsewhere. Issues that are very far-reaching, very global in both origin and effect. And I think the result ultimately of those discussions is for us to realize that we can't just fence off forest areas here and there and expect that just with that action, those forests will necessarily be okay, because there are many things, many challenges that we face environmentally today that are so far-reaching.
Could you kind of talk a little bit about the amphibian declines that have been seen both globally and within Monteverde?
Well, I think some of the factors that the amphibian declines specifically have involved, in many cases, the almost instantaneous crash of many primarily highland populations of amphibians, particularly in tropical America and Australia, but in many other parts of the world as well. And the factors that have been implicated as possible causes in different areas have included everything from pollution, which is a problem both locally in Costa Rica and, of course, globally. Ozone depletion and the effects that UV might have, particularly on amphibian eggs. The introduction of non-native predators, whether that be large ones, vertebrate predators, or small ones like various pathogens, viruses, fungal disease, etc. All of those things are aided to one degree or another by our own activities.
Has Monteverde in particular seen any amphibian species disappear within the past few years, or is it simply just numbers decreasing among species?
In Monteverde, I think the pattern was similar to what happened in a number of other places. We lost a large number of species really from one year to the next, between 1987 and 1988 specifically. In our region, about half the species vanished or became so rare they were undetectable in that one year, and the other half, for the most part, dropped to fractions of the numbers that there had been prior to the crash. So the event was really quite dramatic here and in many other areas. Since that time, there has been some recovery. Small populations of some of the species have reappeared in different parts of Monteverde, in some cases in other outlying areas. For some of us, the whole event and the whole pattern is suggestive of an epidemic that some species had resilience to, in which a few fortunate individuals, for whatever reason, may have been resilient to and have started to come back. And there is quite a lot of evidence that one particular fungal epidemic may have been the cause of that. There has been debate about the possible role in this and other events of climate change. I think the jury is out on whether climate change or how climate change might have influenced a disease epidemic, if it did at all. But for whatever the reason, the loss was very large in Monteverde.
And I could be wrong, but Monteverde lost a species that not put it on the map, but was endemic to Monteverde and was important locally.
Yeah, the golden toad was a very distinctive amphibian in that the males are or were bright orange. The females were also very attractive with a black and red and white mottled pattern. And it was one that had been quite famous. It was only described scientifically for the first time in the 1960s, very late. And it had formed a centerpiece of one of the first major land purchase campaign for conservation in Monteverde, which led to the creation of the Monteverde Cloud Forest Preserve. Thus, when it disappeared, it was somewhat of a shock because for many people, that was a species whose habitat had been set aside by conservation efforts. And that event, I think, is a wake-up call to everyone in terms of looking at these big global issues.
And you did some work with research on the amphibian populations within Monteverde.
I worked for Alan Pounds as he tried to quantify the decline shortly after they took place and to look for possible patterns and explanations. It was a project that he ran for 5 years. And more recently, I worked on a project with Chester Zoo from Britain to look at one of the possible explanations, to look at the distribution of fungal infection in some of the species that had been affected. My focus, in one way or another, is environmental education. So although I have been involved in helping out with some of these studies, and it's a theme that, you know, is of great interest to me, and I think it's an issue in which, because I spend quite a lot of time in the field, you know, I've made a series of observations and noticed a lot of species coming back that I think are patterns that need to be looked at and need to be studied and enjoy participating in research. Really, I'm not a scientist, so my typical day is not a day of research. My typical day is a day focused on environmental education. My own work is quite varied. I spend some of my time teaching courses, and we spend a lot of that time in the field, as you have seen, looking at species and species interactions and the implication of all those things for conservation. And that is a never-ending voyage of discovery for me, still today. And I greatly enjoy spending part of my time researching things in order to try to gain some understanding of all that we know and the much greater amount that we don't know about organisms and how they interact on the one hand, and finding ways to try to convey that to students and sometimes guides in an engaging fashion.
You are an artist as well as a scientist, and I know that just throughout Costa Rica, we've seen your images everywhere, your art everywhere, in different guides. I wasn't sure how you felt about art as a means of creating interest in the environment, or kind of helping the cause through art.
Well, you know, art was the entryway, if you like, into all of this for me personally, but it's really, at this point, as I mentioned, broadened into an interest in education and conservation. So it's morphed, it's evolved somewhat. And although I'm very, very fond of art, and I think it has an important role for me personally, art has probably started to play a somewhat smaller role as I've become more interested in education and conservation. So although that was my entry point, I think today art is one means to tell a story or to help tell a story. And it's something I love to employ here and there, but I've also become, or I would perhaps equally interested in photography and in recording sound and in film and so on. And of course in written storytelling, which I think is perhaps even more important, and or verbal storytelling. So I think the important thing, at least for me at this stage, is telling the story. And art may or may not be a part of that. Go on, a semi-critical rant. It's not really, but I think I expressed this in a similar fashion right at the beginning. But let me express it. See if I do it a slightly different way and you can see. I think that someone with a less scientific bent on the one hand, but perhaps, you know, more than that, just from what I see, the art of storytelling, whether it's through art or writing or film, and doing it in a more meaningful way than it is done generally now, is fundamental if we are going to protect what little pristine natural resources we have left in the world with a quickly growing human population. And I don't think that's done well all that often. I think that the scientific community, you know, tends to find out all kinds of fascinating things, but often publishes them in obscure places that few people are likely to see, in a language that most people would find somewhat intimidating. And that is very important. It has to be done that way. That's the way rigorous, accurate, reviewed science is done, and that is the cornerstone. But if that information is not conveyed in a more appealing fashion without cheapening it, without making it so simple as to, you know, remove the complexity and the fascination of it to a general public who I think for the most part is perfectly capable of understanding complexities and fascinating details if they're presented in the right way, then we're going to continue to have problems. And if you look at, let's say, if we were to take election topics as some indication of what's on people's minds and, you know, what people really care about. Well, I could say, let's take in the US and the current cycle of presidential debates and so on, that in, now tens of hours of presidential debates in either party, environmental considerations take very much second stage, they're barely mentioned. And I think that we continue to be on a, despite all the echo babble that surrounds us in some areas in the US anyway, Costa Rica also, the widespread unawareness of the importance of the natural environment, of the complexity and the fragile, is taking us, and complacency with the status quo, this notion that still that somehow nature will be all right, that I'm not sure that people realize how much, how drastically we have changed the face of the earth in just a few short decades. I don't think people realize how much of that will continue or will have consequences that in some cases we're just beginning to see retroactively, so to speak, or after the fact. I just don't think that we are close as a human race to understanding that our natural surroundings, you know, whether it's in a tremendously biodiverse place like Costa Rica, but, you know, all sorts of equally special natural wilderness areas and temperate areas in the US and elsewhere in the world, without a much more effective effort at conveying why that's special, we're not going to make enough steps to change to preserve, you know, what little we have left. And political discussions in the US and elsewhere certainly don't suggest that it's front and fore on anyone's agenda.
Any words of inspiration for aspiring scientists or general good citizens?
I'll mention the a very inspirational story from our area that probably has played itself out in different ways in other parts of the world, but in Monteverde, a small conservation organization was formed in 1986. It was called the Monteverde Conservation League. And the following year, a biologist who had been working in Monteverde, Sharon Kinsman, was on a personal trip to Sweden and was asked to give a presentation about the rainforest to a group of kids. And those kids got inspired by what they heard and the realization that they could, in their small way, raise awareness and raise funds to try to protect and cherish some of that special environment. And their effort in a pre-internet age went viral, so to speak, and led to a multinational campaign with extensive participation of children from all around the world, and led to the creation in a few short years, really, of what today is the largest private reserve in Central America, the Children's Eternal Rainforest. And that vision has been perpetuated since simply by the passion and effort of individuals, not some magic supreme entity that made it happen, but just small efforts by multiple people pulling the rope, so to speak. And that forest is today certainly one of the reservoirs of the greatest biodiversity in the world. And I think that it's an important, you know, an inspiring story that should remind us all that efforts by individuals who are not necessarily super wealthy or super politically connected or powerful in some other way can make tremendous change. And I'm sure there are examples around upstate New York of such initiatives. And in the realm of conservation, the Children's Eternal Rainforest is probably one of the better known stories in the world and really is a great example.
I'm Chloe Larson. I'm a neuroscience major, senior. I'm from Westchester, New York.
So you visited Monte Verde and that area when you were a kid. Do you want to kind of talk about what you were doing there?
Yeah, so I went there because in my elementary school in fourth grade, there's this whole project to raise money for the rainforest. And so we would just have a bake sale outside of the school, and the school was in New York City, so get a lot of money from that. Actually, everyone had to do some sort of a project that would be displayed at the bake sale, and we raised quite a bit of money. And then over the summer after that year, I wanted to raise more money on my own because I got into that and I didn't really have too much to do that summer. So at my apartment building in the city, outside of it, we set up a lemonade stand, bake sale, everything. I had a green iguana, which is a native species to the rainforest, which I got from an animal rescue shop, so it wasn't like, you know, exporting it from the rainforest or anything. I would not want to do that. But anyway, I had him on my shoulder, and, you know, it was very rainforest-themed, like, lemonade stand on the city. So we made a lot of money from that, and we contributed that to the school's fund for the rainforest. And the school did not know that this was part of a competition or a contest to raise money. And basically, the top three schools that raised the most money got to send one person from the school. So they chose me to go to the rainforest. So it was me and three other people and my dad and my science teacher in the rainforest. And we went in the summer of 2005. I think it was in August. So it was in, like, pretty much peak wet season. So it was pretty rainy when we were there, which is pretty different than how it was when class went this year. And we were really just there kind of doing similar things to what we did, but at an elementary school level. And we had the same guide, Mark Wainwright, which is really coincidental, really cool, because he's awesome. And we stayed at this person, Rachel Crandall, who has since passed away, but she was really organizing the whole fundraising thing to get funds from the U.S. and to sort of continue this sort of tradition of kids raising funds for the Children's Eternal Rainforest. And so I don't think that fundraising is going on anymore because she's not there anymore. But so we were with her the whole time. We stayed at her house, which was in Monteverde, which was really cool. It was in the forest. There was like a big hollow strangler fig that we could climb up in her backyard. It was really cool. We like slept in hammocks in her like sort of indoor-outdoor room. And then we also went to San Gerardo for a couple nights. So it was cool to go back there.
What got you excited about the rainforest at that age?
We had to each learn about an animal. So I learned about the emerald boa constrictor, and I thought that guy was really cool. Of course, I didn't see it then, and we didn't see it this time either. But it was really cool to see all the animals that everyone else was learning about, and I was always really into animals. Like, I had an iguana. I had, like, so many lizards in my house and birds and things like that that we had gotten from this animal rescue place. So just that love of animals, I guess, and that there were all those creatures in the rainforest. So, and then also the message that the rainforest had to be saved, because, you know, in fourth grade they're just sort of simplifying this whole thing. They're like, you know, we need to save the rainforest, our teachers, and so we're raising money to save the rainforest. And that, those words sort of, okay, yeah, we need to save the rainforest. So definitely about conservation and also wanting to see cool animals. So,
what was it like to go back to Monteverde? Had anything changed? Was it different to see it through the lens of a senior college student?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, there are a couple like key differences. When I was there the first time, like I said, it was the middle of the wet season. So everything was a lot more lush when I was there the first time than it was this time, because it was the middle of the dry season this time. So it was kind of cool to see it in two completely different seasons. But it also made it hard to gauge how much it had changed since I had been there, because I was noticing that everything was a lot drier, especially on the Pacific side. But I didn't know if that was because it was the dry season or because it had been deforested more and climate change had gone on a lot since I was there. So, yeah. And being a college senior now, it's, I know a lot more about all of these things that we were learning about. And just having been in the tropical ecology class and having been in the tropical ecology seminar to go to Costa Rica, we obviously learned a lot about the rainforest that when we went there, I was able to recall, and that was really cool to know. And then I think my memory is obviously a lot better now, so I'm able to remember what Mark was saying. Mark says a lot on the trail, and he did when we were there in fifth grade, and I don't think I remembered even like retained that information when he was teaching it to us then, but this time definitely a lot more, and having to write it down in our field notebooks, of course. A lot more. Yeah.
So going back this past trip, I'm sure you felt a lot of nostalgia. Do you feel connected to Monteverde? Like, do you think
definitely. So Skylar and I have been talking about living there eventually, because my family also has friends who do live there, so they could help us figure out how to live there. But before we would do that, we're thinking of going there right after we graduate for like a month or so, staying at San Gerardo for a week and just being able to go back to those places and have time to relax, because when we were there, we were constantly doing things and, you know, not necessarily just lie in the hammock the whole time, but just be able to walk the trails at our own pace and things like that. And then explore new areas too, all the volcanoes and just different habitats. Since we saw so many when we were there, there's obviously so many more to explore, and maybe use half of that time volunteering somewhere, like staying in one place for a long time would be really cool, helping out. So.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, especially since we, you know, this summer don't really have much to do other than applying for jobs. It'd be kind of a cool thing to do. So hopefully it works out.
Yeah, I hope it works out for you guys. and then do you want to talk about the event that you will have at Earth Day this weekend that you and Skylar are planning?
Yes. So me and Skylar had this idea, but I think the whole class is really getting on board now to have this bake sale at Earth Day. It's a perfect day to have a bake sale for the rainforest, obviously. And we will have a lot of our projects that we've been doing for this class about the rainforest. Skylar and I specifically will have a couple posters that are really designed to convince people of the importance of raising money for this organization, the Children's Eternal Rainforest, which is one of the main reserves that we stayed on. And it really needs money, so if everybody can come and donate money and get a treat, it would be really great. La linda guaria morada, flor de esta tierra bendita, se encuentra como un lucero colgadita en la enramada, cuando en lo oscuro el jilguero va enredando su tonada. Por la orilla de los ríos, adornando las quebradas, donde son los montes fríos y están las aguas heladas.
Florecita lindo paje, florecita nazarena, veluto de tu ropaje es el mismo de mi pena. El jazmín siempre blanquea y sangran las amapolas, solo en febrero tumbea el amor. Florecita veranera de la pampa y de la loma, como tú soy primavera, como tú no tengo aroma. Sobre la tapia entejada, en la roca y el raudal, la guaria morada, la linda flor nacional. Ella es emblema y escala, que embellece y glorifica, como un cela que echó ala, que protege a Costa Rica. Que protege a Costa Rica.